Station number 17441.
Norman Smith, Rio 4.
So we were very happily ensconced in this very pleasant little place. It was early summertime. We were getting £3 a day. We had to be back for 1 o'clock. And then we worried in case we were going to be whipped off. Anyway, once the word got through, normally by about 2 we weren't wanted. I had arranged a very nice liaison with a young girl that lived or was in an office nearby. So we used to go to the pictures and have a meal and return. And I got the idea this would be a very nice way to sit the war out, actually. Anyway, the day came, away we went. I didn't know what aerodrome we went from, but somebody said it was Thamesford. And it was quite late because they didn't want us till, I think it was somewhere in middle of August before we went off. But we went somewhere and we were put in a big field and meadow with all these tents and thousands of paras. So I don't know what that lot was for. And then we went off in a Stirling. I think there was another team with us, but I can't remember who. There was just Major Johnson, Commandant Francois, and myself in the Stirling. The first time we went over, I'm not sure whether we got shot at, but we had to come back and spend another night in the tent. Then it turns out we were the farthest in. We were right over on the Swiss border, and we went into a small village called Monte Cheroux, very near to, but in the Besançon area. On the map I've been given, there's a whole nest of teams went in about that time.
What day did you go in?
I think it was about 23rd, 24th of August. Into this lovely little village, about 5 minutes running time, I believe, from the Swiss border. We jumped in through this reception committee. I've got a feeling we went into a truck or a car, and we were hidden in a farmhouse, and then we moved into a small village. It was only occupied for a very, very short time before the Germans pulled out, so we had to hide. We were split up. I lived in a house with a very, very old lady. Somebody had stabbed a German, and they lined up about a dozen people, as they used to do, in front of the square. And they said unless the people owned up, they'd shoot everybody. So they used to bring three out every midday and shoot them off. Then they all cleared out.
Who all cleared out?
The Germans then cleared out. The resistance was quite strong, but Johnson, my boss, was very very military minded, and he'd got himself involved in all sorts of things. He also didn't like the French. The boss we dropped into was an American Frenchman that ran the district, and we were supposed to drop in to help him out, you know, in various ways. But there was just so much radio work, pretty well all I did was radio work. Then we moved to a farm somewhere again, which was, you'd meet German patrols. Then that was cleared up. Then we went into another little village. There were three places, all of the most gorgeous names. Monte Cheroux, Monte La Grande, Saucy La Glise, Saucy La Grande, all on this main road, all little sort of little huddles. Then we moved into this lovely little village, and right at the end of the main street the mountain rose up, and it was just a tiny little commercial travellers inn. And there's some of the French places, when you went in the front door, that's where the kitchens were. So we moved into there, and then all the Senegalese troops came in, and it was getting winter time. And my impression is they were all sitting down, huddled around little fires, all sitting in the doorways, and they all had watches all the way up their arms and rings, because when they got hold of any Germans, sometimes they killed them, otherwise they didn't. They used to chop their fingers off and pull the rings off and take all their watches off. By this time I'd become heavily involved with a lady captain out of the army, French medical corps. So this was quite a happy interlude. She had to leave us, and the American typhoons, I'm very fond of Americans, They were travelling along the road and the Americans strafed them with rockets, and the whole of her medical unit was wiped out.
How had you met her?
Well, when I was in this little hotel, Johnson was away all the time because all I did was radio work, you see. The officers learnt very quickly, don't get your operator killed, because they didn't know much about Morse. And not that any of us wanted to be heroic, but they decided that keep us safe at all times, otherwise they're going to have a problem because they can't get in contact. So the war was more or less over by this time. So I was having lunch there one day, and in came this gorgeous American captain wanting to speak to my boss.
American or French?
French girl, rather. French army doctor she was. Came from Portugal originally, a French Portuguese. So we struck up a very great friendship. And I don't know whether this should be on the record or not, but she was billeted in a private house. And to get to her sleeping quarters, I had to get on this wall, and I could just reach up to the balcony where her bedroom was. And I was able to haul myself up on the balcony, tap on the bedroom window, and she would say, forget the war for a while. And then return via the same route. Anyway, shortly after...
Where was this hotel?
This was in the little village of Saucy-le-Grand or Saucy-le-Glise or whichever this little place was. Then we drove across France to Paris with Major Johnson.
Just before you go off to Paris, if I could just ask you about one or two things. When you said somebody didn't like the French, who were you referring to?
Well, as we were on record, we'd have to be careful, but the team boss, I don't think he got on very well with the French. You know, he'd had dealings with them in North Africa. And
what irritated him in particular?
Well, they sent me up his reports on what he did, you know, what he was actually doing. And he seemed to be very upset that all the things he was suggesting and said should be done, which probably were quite right, were not able to be done. Although in his letter he praises everybody he worked with, which was very political and advisable, but there was an awful lot of people who were anti-French.
So it was because his suggestions were not carried out?
I think so, yes, yeah. And I don't think, as a regular officer, he wasn't, because he never came on to anymore, you see, most of them carried on, but he didn't like the whole idea. All regulars thought this lot was a lot of nonsense, which probably was, you know, looking back on it all.
You mean because they thought it was illegitimate?
Well, for the amount of manpower and for the amount of training and the amount of hours, they really were trying to justify themselves. I mean, I'm just an illiterate, but I mean, the only reason for Arnhem was Montgomery's bloody nonsense. They'd spent millions training all these thousands and thousands of men, and they didn't know what the hell to do with them. And it was their last chance of glory. The plan was crazy. It was totally inconceivable. The Germans packed up parachuting after Crete, didn't they? They never used parachutes again.
But from what you observed yourself, how much do you think that your team achieved in the Besançon area?
Well, there was a lot of teams in that area. It's difficult to say that, you see, the Germans had such a total grasp. What people don't realise is, how could the French have been so easily dominated? How could the Germans have got the whole of Europe? Well, if there was a lieutenant in charge of a town and he was told, I mean, you might not necessarily see Gestapo, you might just see SS troops, but if just an ordinary lieutenant was in charge of a town and he was told to root out resistance, they'd stop anybody. They didn't care who they stopped. They'd torture anybody on the basis that they might pick something up. They were a lieutenant or a captain in a town was answerable to nobody. They could just stop anybody on the street and say, bring half a dozen in, tear their eyes out, torture them, stick out things up their umpums. We might land somebody. And sometimes they did. And then if they did get the real people, they'd kill all their bloody, or put all their relations into concentration camps. So you've got to realise all the way along that whoever you were dealing with the German army, had total power. Now, looking back on it, all that was spent on us and all that we did, we all went in too late. But could we have done anything had we gone in earlier? Because the Germans had got into all these networks. I mean, I've got a croix de guerre that says I didn't even speak French. What the hell was I doing there?
But did you need French?
Well, it would have helped, wouldn't it? As it was, you couldn't converse with the Germans because they were very anti-British. You couldn't converse with the French because very few of them spoke English. So basically, I didn't even know where I was. The whole thing was a mystery to me. That's my proudest possession. Even though he knew no French, he did not hesitate to move around in civilian clothes. I thought you're dead right about that.
Did you have any scares whilst you were
there? Yes. Oh, yes. Once or twice they've got... They might jump on you by surprise, you know.
And you'd have to move up. Describe the incidents where you had the scares.
There was only one when we were walking, we were moving, and luckily we'd got nothing with us. But we went through this village, and for some unknown reason, I was with a couple of Frenchmen, one who spoke a fair amount of English, and we had to move, but there was no way of doing it. And we just got stopped by just an ordinary pair of German soldiers that didn't like the looks of us. And I had some papers, which I've since lost. And I said very little, but fortunately the German knew as little French as I knew them. But if you ever met up with the French, the milice, or the educated Germans, well, they could speak English, French and German happily, so they'd have had you within a minute. So they just said, sort of buggered off. We had a big scare one night on the dropping. Them and the Germans were supposed to come as we were getting the drop in, and we all had to bugger off. Got chased once, but that was about it. Didn't get involved in any fighting because our job wasn't really to get involved in the fighting. I mean, Franchomme, the French officer, he got shot the first time he went anywhere. And he'd got an MC in the desert. He was the son of a French field marshal. He was in the Foreign Legion. And he and I had shared a great hatred of anything physical. And he was a funny little man, very, very thin. And whenever we came to doing physical training, we had to leap over these horses, without using our hands. "This is dangerous, Smith. It's dangerous. We're not going to do this." I said, "You're dead right." So we used to duck out on everything we could. Anyway, he got an MC and he was trying to get into a German tank with his sword. And he told me a lot of things about the Foreign Legion, of how to make people tell you things they don't want to tell you without really hurting them. And he said in the Foreign Legion, because he was in it pre-war, if you had difficulty, there are some men you will never break. They are just totally and wonderfully heroic. You could march them around all day with packs, you could beat them, you could thump them, you could deprive them, and they were superb soldiers, but they were trouble when there was no war. So what they did, used to tie their hands up, tie their ankles up, and they used to push their knees between there, like that. I can't
between
do it.
Between their arms.
Then they used to stick a wooden pole or a steel pole between, and they used to go for the smoke. And after half an hour or an hour, the cramps start getting in, and they go potty. They don't come back for any more of that. These are the guys, if they're Germans, who have their teeth pulled out with no anaesthetic, because we're Germans. The English and the French, they're cowards. It was us. How many for? They never had anaesthetic. Pull them out. Most of them were NCOs, and they were harder than the bloody blokes that beat the daylights out of everybody within sight. So it's easy to understand why the Germans had complete control of everybody. So had we gone in earlier, I think we'd have all been killed. And we went in too late, I think, to do any good. But of course, some went in earlier, and some went in... Every team went in a different area. The boys that went in earlier had much danger, whereas with us, it was all pretty well settled. I always got the feeling, that if the resistance had only been sensible, they'd have just said, "Oh, we'll leave this, the war's nearly over." But they dropped in some SAS with jeeps, and they went around shooting at the Germans and holding up trains. Of course, the Germans became annoyed, and they started looking for us. So it was sort of Very answer. Anyway, the war came to an end.
But this, when you had the scare with the German,
yeah,
he was just an ordinary German soldier.
Yeah, they were just two ordinary German soldiers, stopped us for some unknown reason. Because had they been the real boys, they'd have took you in anyway, you see. And of course, we'd have had it then. We'd have ended up in the Gestapo and Buchenwald. And then we flew home from Paris in December 44. And we had been told early on that after Europe, if we wanted to go on, we were going to go to Burma, which was practice for Malaya, where they thought the main resistance was going to go. So Major Johnson got arrested with me in Croydon Airport, because we'd got no identification. He'd got some fabulous pass, which I also had a smaller edition, which said, you know, next to de Gaulle, he was the most important person in the world, and he didn't like the way the Air Force treated him at Croydon Airport. So they put us both in cling. Eventually it was found that he was all right. And we went into the officer's mess there to wait for Colonel Carlton Smith, I think his name was, who was head of the thingy bob. He sent his car
head
down.
Head of what?
Carlton Smith. He was head of Special Forces in Baker Street. I've got a letter from him. My dad wrote and asked where I was, you see, and he wrote to my father, and I've still got the letter saying, do please send, do continue to write to your son. He is alive and well, and any messages will be sent to him. Because they must have checked that Dad was in the police, you see, so they felt happy in writing that. So Johnson had had this row with authority because he was rather important. And we got slung in the jug. Anyway, they cleared up who we were, and Carlton Smith sent his car for Johnson. Johnson said to me, you say you're a lieutenant, because we're going to go in the officer's mess, he said. So we weren't, nobody was wearing any rank, you see. And I remember chatting to the people in there and telling them a bit and pieces about what happened. The car came, dropped Johnson off at wherever he lived in London, and then took me home in the car with all my stuff. To Bedison Road. The greatest thing of all, which you may have been told, is the officers were given 100,000 francs. Big, lovely coloured things, like the equivalent of our white fivers, to help us if we were, you know, in trouble, to buy this, to buy that. And we were given 50,000, which was £250. Now, I had no need to use any of mine, but some of mine went to someone who shall be nameless, that went to Switzerland in order to buy his fiancée a watch. So I was requested, would I sort of give some contribution? So I said, certainly. I was quite happy. And when we came back home, we had to go to Baker Street, and an officer who shall be nameless, but who is still alive, was in charge of the records, who had been in Europe with us. And you were asked to account for your money. So he said, have you got any money left? So I said, well, only a little. I said, anyway, where are we supposed to spend it on? He said, well, go through what the other fellas have done, you know, buying radio batteries, buying this, buying that, money taken for the resistance, money taken for that. Well, I got about 130 quid. So somebody came in and said to me, go round the banks, don't go in uniform, and every 1,000 franc notes, you'll get a fiver. Oh, I thought, this is right up my street. So this is a little exaggeration, but to my mind, this is how it was. Have various amounts in each pocket, depending on, so you didn't know if they didn't like it, or the military police might be on, or it was against the law. But there were so many people in London with foreign money at this time. The invasion had been and gone. It was December. So you might have 4,000 francs there, that was £20. You might have 6 in the other one. So, depending on how they took it, you were ready with, that's all the money I have, you see. So, I know what started it off. Johnson told me at the airport, you can change French money once we got liberated. So I said, how much are you going to change? Oh, he said, I think I can get about £50 worth here. So we got £50 worth of French francs, and got the £5 notes for each of those. So we got about 25 quid each. That's what started it off. So everywhere you went in London, there were fellas in Macs and raincoats saying, excuse me, do you change French francs here? Yes, sir, how many do you have? Well, how many do you change? £30. Oh, yes. Yes, I just happened to have £30 here. And I got rid of all mine like that and getting these lovely white fivers for them. So I thought, that's just, you know, this is not a bad way to fight a war. And I had agreed to go out to Burma for practice. And I was one of the last to come out of Europe. There was only Tom Henney and I. All the others had gone on.
Tom who?
Tom Henney. He's now dead. He was a Liverpool operator. And that's where Arthur Dupré Denning, who you may well have heard of, I was on the Orontes going out with him. And he must have looked through the records. And he said, we don't know what we're going out to, Norm. And he said, but would you like to be my radio operator, boy, whatever goes on in Burma? So I was greatly honoured, you know, someone like him wanting me as a radio operator. So I said, certainly, sir.
Which month is this that you're going out to
Burma? This will be January 44, because we came out in December.
45?
Yeah, it is, yeah, 45. By which would be awaiting my 21st birthday, which I had in Aden.
So you teamed up with him?
Yeah. And then we went out to Horana. We went to Colombo. The troop ship was great because we were the only two army blokes on the troop ship. And we were up on the top deck with all the three Australian air crews that had done their tour of duty over Britain. And we're all going home. So it was a rip-roaring, boisterous occasion. Tom Henney was always getting involved with fights with them. My fondest memory is they were nearly all warrant officers and they were as tough as they come. They'd all done, you know, 30 ops. And there was hardly any nosh on the troop ship. We were all starving, as you could imagine. Used to get two kippers and two slices of bread and butter. And there was 12 on our table or something, and there should be 14. So there's always two kippers and two slices of bread left. So the colonia was being very fair-minded. Said, the only way to share these out is everybody has a fork in his right hand, and when one of us blows the whistle, every man for himself. Well, I can remember being flung across the room. I can remember being stamped on. I can remember having a fork dug in my ear, but I can't ever remember getting an extra kipper or even a bit of bloody bread and butter. But it passed away the time, and we were in lovely quarters in bunks on the top deck, so it was super. And we came into Calcutta.
And Calcutta? Of
course, yeah, we came into Calcutta on the trooper. And that was for my first impression of the East when we got to Suez. To wake up one morning and for the first time, no blackout. All these colours. It's just like a Technicolor film. It's unbelievable. Then you were about 3 days and two nights or vice versa on the train down from Calcutta down to Colombo. And as you go further south and further south in India, it gets more deserty. And of course we had, it's like ship's bunks. Whereas the poor old ordinary troops are living and wouldn't, you know, sit up things. We had just like ship's cabins with two bunks, our own toilet. And the doors are open and the two bunks come down at night. And you stop for meals there. They didn't have meals on the train. They used to go along to the restaurant, they'd pull up at the restaurant. We all got out. And then the little boy was sitting in the sun pulling the ponka wallah thing while we noshed. And we all got back on the train and chugged off again till dinner time. And then crossed by the Goshen to Ceylon. And to this day I can see the Ceylon coastline coming up. And everywhere was green, all the palm trees and all the trees. And the trains went through a tunnel of trees. And there was no beggars and very few people. Whereas India is just millions of them. Every time a train stopped in India, as you'd probably know, the more their children are deformed, the more money they get. So when they're young, they break their arms and they break their legs. And the poor little... Every station you stop, there are just thousands of the poor devils. In the end, you have to just ignore them. And they're all trying to sell something or beg. And it's just... It's alive. And you get down to Ceylon and there was relatively few people and it was all quiet and it was a backwater. And we did a bit of jungle training. Then off we went to Burma.
But the team, can you tell me about the composition of the team?
Yeah, well,
that was formed?
Then there wasn't enough of us, and this is what caused a lot of trouble, which of course I didn't know about at my level. But there was many the people that came out from Europe thought they knew more than the people that weren't in Europe, and the people that had lived out east and knew all about it realized that we were bloody useless. We didn't speak the language, we weren't used to the climate, we didn't know anything. I mean, the people, the forestry commission fellas, the planters and all that, they told them the Japs would come down through Malaya. They were doing it themselves. They were walking through these jungles. The British said, oh no, they'll never do it, they can't do it. Bloody well did. So trouble was caused. Now, Denning, I didn't know anything about what was going on. Nobody told us. But it turned out we were part of an operation called Character, which was to take over the hills so the armies could come down the road in the middle.
It was called Operation Character.
Yeah, it was Character. The whole business of that particular, what we were trained for and came out from you, it was called Character. And it was a Lieutenant Colonel Peacock ran some big area. Our colonel was Colonel Cromarty Tulloch. There were four lieutenant colonels. And Denning was my boss. And they did a more or less similar structure to Europe, in the fact that Denning was in charge of a team which consisted of him and Major Cockle, who was an accountant with the Burma Oil Company, had lived in Burma for years, spoke Burmese, and did not get along. You'll have to be careful with this, but did not get along with Denning. You see, there's always a conflict between the two. And in the end, Cockle went out on his own elsewhere, and I stayed with Denning, who was a superb man.
But what was the... Why was the friction between them?
I don't know, because it was the political... You see, nobody had been in the area for years. Seagram was caught and executed by the Japs. The average Burmese were pro-Japanese because of they fell for this rising Asia co-prosperity thing the Japs had. All whites are bastards. Now, the Burmese are a nasty lot anyway. So nobody knew how they were going to work because they were collaborators. So you had to be careful. Now, old Pop Tulloch was 56, and he'd lived out east for years. He'd got two mentions in dispatches in the Great War, and he wore a monocle and a white beard. And nobody was more suitable for Special Forces, because like the rest of us, he was totally deranged. He was given an idea of dropping somewhere in that area. So there was Pop peering out of the door at 56 with his monocle, looking for a place to drop. Unbeknown to us, at Loy Kaur, there was a Japanese division.
At where?
Loy Kaur, which was the town where we were supposed to drop near. There was a Japanese division there. But nobody knew, because nobody had been there for years. And the one thing the Japanese are aware of, if you know, transport aeroplanes are buzzing around, there's going to be some excitement. The whole system was totally... Whoever invented it was a maniac of the first order. Because Pop Tulloch, Woody as his operator, who's now dead, a captain called Troward, who was signals officer in charge, I will say no more, as Burmese special group, Tiny Lewis, who was 16 stone odd and a tough big rugby player, and another man out of the Burma Oil Company,